The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast. Hello, everybody. This is yet another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. We discuss everything vascular and not. And today we are discussing a potentially non-vascular, I guess, topic in many ways. It is a super, super true honor to be able to welcome to this podcast my best friend for many, many years and my bestie when we were in med school, Dr. Luis Corrales Rodriguez, who is a medical oncologist. And we went to our medical school together, Lucas. We are absolutely not going to focus on any of our personal stories.
At least one good story.
Maybe we'll get into one or two stories of ours from back in the day.
Jesus Christ.
We toured Europe with a couple of backpacks and we had a lot of fun. Yeah. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
So anyway, Luis, or as we, most of us, that know of, Beto, because it's Luis Alberto is his name. So Beto, it's a pleasure to have you here in the podcast. And I know it was last minute and I know you have some family things you have to attend, but thanks for carving an hour out of your time and spending it with us.
My pleasure to be here. I really appreciate the invitation.
I think you'll find it fun. Yeah. We try to make it a very intimate conversation and you know, we just want to learn a lot more about who you are. Target audience, I think, is probably a lot of younger people, people that are finishing their specialty training, probably in the cardiovascular disease area, and or people that are relatively kind of recently graduated and that take their information in a different way than maybe some of us or some of the older people that we know. And so the podcast has become a very interesting way to get into their ears, into their intimacy, into their cars when they're driving in the morning. So anyway, Beto, one of the things, and you know, we'll kind of back up and get back into it, but the reason why I wanted to bring Beto in is because Beto has been able to build, amongst with a group of professionals in Costa Rica, a top-class research facility providing care for patients with cancer. And that has become both an academic roster. It's become a place where a lot of private companies come and invest as sponsors to generate some data. And he's been incredibly successful at doing that. And I thought that given the fact that there is a lot of barriers to research currently in America, every time I go to a different meeting now, people are asking me because they know my relationship with Costa Rica and they know that I've done a lot of OUS studies. They ask me, hey, what's happening in Costa Rica? Is there anything that we could do research-wise? And I'm always saying yes, because obviously I'm biased and I want an excuse to go back home.
Yeah.
And then the other interesting thing that's happening, and I'd like your opinion here in a bit, Beto, but there is a explosion of industry-based in the sense that they're actually creating products. Every single big company that I work with, Boston Scientific, Inari, Limflow, Abbott, they have a large industrial complex in Costa Rica because they have these tax safe havens and they develop the wires and the balloons and the pacemakers that we implant on a daily basis. And so it'd be interesting to see what that development has created. And if in any way, shape or form, it overlays with some of the success that you've had in your endeavor. So anyway, Beto, maybe if you can start us off with a bit of a summary of what you do, you know, how many years have you been doing this? And then we'll start kind of diving into what made you build a this mecca of research.
Well, thank you. Thank you again for the invitation. So as you told the audience, I'm a medical oncologist. I did my specialty here in Costa Rica. And then I had the opportunity to go to Canada for 2 years to have a little bit more focus on thoracic oncology and gastrointestinal oncology. When I returned to Costa Rica, I had the motivation of what I had seen in Canada related to research. And in Costa Rica, classically, we had a very good environment for research. But around 2008, 2009, there was a law that banned research for quite some years here in Costa Rica.
So what when was I reached Beto, sorry to interrupt. What was the purpose of this law? Obviously, I don't remember this, but can you walk me through why and what it stipulated?
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of research here in Costa Rica. I mean, a lot of pediatric research, a lot of infectious disease oncology research, but there was no law that really guided clinical research as a law as itself. So there was like a sort of some regulations and some issues that we had, but there was no law. So politically, there were some people in the government that said we need a law for clinical research. And so they started to work on that. But before, I mean, having the law, they said, well, we need to stop because we do not have the law. So, I mean, instead of continuing all the research that we had here, they just stopped every research until we had the law. So the law was then placed in 2014. Okay, and then there were some issues after that, and after 2014, we started again to have research here in Costa Rica.
So all clinical research, it doesn't matter what phase.
All clinical research. Yes. Oh. So they banned everything until 2014. Okay, so 2014 we started again to have research, but obviously we have had a lack of a lot of things. I mean, a lot of companies had left Costa Rica because of the banning of research. So they went to other countries. For example, Panama. They went to Guatemala and they started to build their research. So when we had the opportunity to again restart research. Unfortunately, we had a lot of we lacked a lot of things. I mean, simple things such as clinical coordinators. I mean, here we didn't have any clinical coordinators because I mean we had I mean maybe 8 years or so without any research. I mean, so we needed to start rebuilding everything around clinical research. So before
we move into that, and just knowing la tusa con la que me rasco, as we say, in my country, do you believe, Beto, that when there was this moratorium or this kind of stop to everything, were there some personal and political problems that you know of? It may have been before your time, because I think this probably happened before you were already doing, but do you know anything on why this happened and why was it so draconian in a way? It doesn't seem like it was the right way to do it. Do you know anything about what was the inspiration behind this?
No, I mean, no, I do not know the reason why they just stopped. I mean, it was a lot of research before that, but I don't know. I mean, probably there was some political issues regarding that, but I mean, I really don't know like a specific reason for them to stop everything. Yeah.
I do remember that there were, and again, this may be very fuzzy in my memory, but I think that there were a few people that were generating a lot of wealth from some of these clinical research endeavors. And I believe that there was some questioning of the ethics behind it, given that all of this was being done with no structure.
No regulation.
Right, yeah. Right. It was like wild, wild west.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I know that there were a lot of people that were sternly questioning if what was happening was the right thing. Now, granted, I don't necessarily think that the right way to do this was to let the government just stop everything, because I'm sure some people would have benefited from a lot of these efforts. But it's the story behind anything in the world. The moment that you let the government get involved, then everything goes to shit. But I understand the regulatory need and to protect the human
there needs to be a safeguard against our worst human tendencies, because you know there's always going to be that person that tries to gain the system for their benefit. So we as a society somehow, and I agree, I don't think people in government are probably smart enough to come up with sensible regulations. The typical senator probably has no clue what the fuck he's doing, right? So how he's going to opine on research, right? They'll pay a lawyer lobbyist from some company to like write something.
But I promise you we'll get back on track here. Yeah. But has your experience as you've visited other countries and or within Costa Rica, and without having to point fingers or name, have you seen there some questionable research activities in your professional lifetime?
I mean, I haven't. I really haven't. I mean, there is the ethics behind everything. I mean, there are obviously all these ethic committees that the protocols need to pass. There is obviously, I mean, I have not experienced anything that is weird around clinical research. Not even before the law here in Costa Rica. I mean, here, even though, I mean, there was no law, I mean, we had obviously all the ethics committees, we have multinational companies coming here and bringing clinical research. So basically, I mean, they did a very good research here. The problem is that there was no law that regulated this, but obviously everything was done, I mean, within the ethics and within that what we know about clinical research.
So it's your understanding that even preceding the law, at least the sponsors would uphold international quality level research and they would.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And exactly. So you come back in 2000. When do you come back from Canada?
So 2012.
So yeah. You come back and since the law hasn't passed until 2014, you're practicing oncology.
Yeah. So I did practice oncology in a regular public hospital. I started to do a little bit of practice. And as soon as the law, was out and was approved by the government, so I thought to myself, I mean, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to pursue. And I started to work little by little to try and to knock on doors on these pharma companies that they obviously had all these clinical research, and many of these had these studies within Latin America. So I started, I mean, to raise the hand and say, well, we here in Costa Rica now have a law for clinical research. Here a parenthesis here about the law. I mean, this is a very good law for clinical research, and it's one of the few countries in the world who has a law by itself for clinical research. And this obviously has helped regulate things, but has also improved many of the timings that sometimes is very difficult in many parts of the world.
I was actually about to ask you. So the 2014 marks the year where this law finally makes it through Congress. And my question is it a good law? Is it a solid one? And B, has it been amended? Has there been a lot of changes throughout the years that have made it better or worse? What's your impression about the legal structure?
Yeah, so the law, I think it's a solid law. Obviously, as anything that starts, it needs to be amended. It needs to be worked around that. There has been some amendments around this, but definitely has been working and has been improving within time.
Tell me a country that has no law. Do you know of a country that doesn't have a structured law?
Well, many countries, for example, Latin America, do not have a clinical research law or a research law. So they work within certain regulations, maybe, but no law as a national. As a national entity, as a national law. Yeah.
Understood. Okay.
So obviously this is a private endeavor. This is, you're not part of any big institution. You're building this yourself. Did you have a background in business? Because you obviously have the scientific background, but to make this a reality, the process of forming it and creating a project, how does that, where does that come from? You know, where did you get educated, or, you know, how did you build that?
No, I do not have any background in business at all. I liked business before, but I didn't have any education within that. So when this law started, as I said, I started to knock around to see if there was any company that would like to reconnect again with clinical research in Costa Rica. And fortunately, at that time, there was a clinical study around lung cancer. So I had been doing my subspecialty in thoracic oncology. So I asked them. This was a very difficult study. Okay. Maybe a little background around lung cancer. So lung cancer has changed a lot.
We love cancer. Tell us more about it.
I know.
Vascular surgeons love.
And this is the lung cancer is the second most important cancer that produces thrombosis.
I know what that is. You mean a clot? A clot. That's a clot that could give you extracted or treated, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So lung cancer was really changing, and we started to look into the molecular basis of lung cancer, and there was a mutation that occurred maybe 5% of the population of lung cancer patients. So this company had a drug that was directed towards this mutation. Okay. So it was a targeted therapy against this mutation. And this was a very difficult population because only 5% of patients had this mutation. So I started to work around this company for us to become a center as to like if the other centers did not have the patients, maybe we could have the patients. Okay, so I started to work on that. And they gave the study here in Costa Rica. This was the first study that opened after the law. Okay, this was in January 2015. Okay, and luckily for us, we managed to enter a patient 2 weeks after they gave us the study. So we had the opportunity to put one patient. After that, we asked for more patients, and we could build this opportunity, and we included at the end three patients. Okay, three patients may seem very few patients, but this particular population is rare. So obviously for these patients, there were metastatic patients, disseminated patients, and importantly, we still have a patient in this study that is receiving still treatment. So this is 8 years. Wow. After we opened, and the patient still is benefiting from this drug. Okay.
That's, you know, what's interesting. I do remember that during med school, we had been exposed to a multitude of clinical scenarios in which research had been incredibly propelled or accelerated in Costa Rica, because of the size of the community. Mm-hmm. And because of the small gene pool that we had.
Mm.
And so I remember that there were some studies that were linking genetic abnormalities to like hearing loss and some other things that had been studied because of how small the country was. And of course, I guess in some way, some controlled inbreeding that would happen because, you know, you don't have necessarily a cultural melting pot as many other places in the world. Has that been your experience that Costa Rica's genetic gene pool is rather contained and that in some way helped you achieve this very unique sub population of patients that were to be enrolled and maybe in other studies too?
Yeah, I mean, definitely in cancer, we have understood in the last maybe 10 years or so that there are genetic conditions that affect populations. So for example, Latin population is very different from a Caucasian population in lung cancer, for example. Okay, so we have been studying this around Latin America, not only in lung cancer, but also we started to work around gastrointestinal cancer, and definitely there are changes and there are differences within the populations that before we didn't know. I mean, before we treat every patient the same, now we understand that there may be some differences that we need to direct treatments in a different way. And as an example, Latin America in general has around maybe 30-35% of patients that are non-smokers. If you go to Caucasian population, it is around maybe 15% or 10-15%. So why is our more non-smoker patients with lung cancer? It has been described, and this has a genetic ancestry that has been related to this. And these are some of the examples that, then why it is important for us to research in our populations and not only read what is published that come from other places.
Yeah, I mean that whole base bias on population makes you think a lot about the things that we do. Because like when I was in San Antonio, where the I would say 60-80% of the people I was treating were from not Latin America, Central America.
Yeah,
their disease process is completely different than a Caucasian, African American, Asian population. And none of the studies are geared toward this specific patient population. So you can say, oh, this is the data, but is it the data? Like, does it apply to what I'm doing? You know, it's, and then you see it, and then there's an absurdity to quoting the data at some point, you know?
Yeah, I mean, not only that, but also gender, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, the gender differences that we have with some of the hormonal differences that we have, we've come to realize that in vascular care, it is a very different scenario. And mm-hmm. so unless the representation of, let's say, the female gender on a particular study is such, you can't extrapolate that in many ways.
And this is important because now big academic entities are understanding these minority differences. And for example, ASCO, which is the American Society of Clinical Oncology, has started to move forward on including these minority populations in this big clinical research these big pharma studies. And that is why some of the population that we see now in the most recent studies need to have a percentage that is adequate for minorities. And that is why also we have been starting to try and to have this research come to Costa Rica and come to other places in Latin America. But obviously in my case, I'm pushing forward on looking for these studies to be started in Costa Rica.
So are these what the and remind me the name of the company the name of the institution that you run?
CIMCA, which is Centro de Investigación y Manejo de Cáncer.
Okay, so CIMCA. So is CIMCA part primarily of multinational, multi-site studies? Is this what, or is it more like, hey, we're going to Costa Rica for a first in human, and we're only going to do 3 patients and that's it? What's the most frequent thing that you're doing? What phase of the study?
So now, for example, in Costa Rica, we are only doing phase 2, 3, and 4. We are not doing any phase 1 clinical studies. So CIMCA has become,
I'm sorry to interrupt before you go into that, but why? Why is phase 1 not appropriate?
This is, phase 1 can be done. They're starting to move the process on, but this is because in the law that was in 2014, the ethics committee that was the only one allowed to approve phase 1 studies was within the Ministry of Health. That was the only one. The rest of phase 2, 3, and 4 can be approved by other type of ethics committees that may be that were approved by the government. Okay, but
so what we call the IRB, the Institutional Review Board?
Yes. So exactly.
If phase 2, 3, and 4, you could have, I guess, privatized IRBs that would consent and approve and regulate. But for phase 1, it was very guarded and would only be within the Ministry of Health, which is a, you know, an institutional government kind of thing, which probably was very sluggish and not really efficient and probably not good for business in a way. Like it didn't make much sense to try to bring them because it was such a hassle to get it through, probably. Is that
right? Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so, that's changing?
They're arranging that for hopefully in a near future to have phase 1. So they are organizing themselves and they have been working, and now they have a working IRB within the Ministry of Health that could approve phase 1.
Okay.
But
interesting.
For now, I mean, we're only focusing in phase 2.
Now you guys have your, so CIMCA has their own IRB that has
No. We have not. I mean, for clarity and everything, we use another institution for IRB. Mm.
What institution do you guys use?
We're doing with ICIMED, which is the Institute of Research from UCIMED.
Okay.
Which is the private university.
Okay.
Here in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you have your first successful trial. You enroll 3 patients in a very small population. Mm-hmm. And then is that your aha moment that this can be something by itself? Is this something what percentage of the time that you've spent working, is it pure patient care, not related to research? Mm-hmm. And what percentage is managing, you know, multiple clinical trials at the same time and such?
Yeah, so with this study, I mean, we obviously had a good information. We did very well on the trial. So, and we need to remember this was a multinational trial. I mean, a multi-site trial. There were around maybe 180 sites open for this trial around the world. Okay, so we managed to have a good opportunity. So they started to have and ask. I mean, are you interested in this trial that is opening? So we started from there to work, and we started as investigator research center. So I mean, there are SMOs, there are CROs, but we started as an investigator research center, and that was something that. Initially for pharma, that was an important because obviously of budget wise, I mean, we could handle a little bit easier everything. And from now and from then on, I mean, we started to receive trials not only from this particular pharma company, but others started to arrive again to Costa Rica and try and offer us other trials, all only focused in oncology. And we have been working around there. I mean, currently I do private practice, which is a good percentage of my time. The big percentage of my time is, again, clinical research. And still, right now I have fewer time for the administrative issues. Before, I needed to do a lot of hours for administration. I mean, and we started to build around there.
The process around it. Mm-hmm. If you would think, if you put your business hat on and you would think about other types of clinical research, device related, say, would you say that there's an opportunity in Costa Rica to build a place where, you know, patients and companies and startups could, you know, kind of both bring their needs, patients needing care, high-end care, say in the vascular space, and companies needing to produce data to support that care in other markets? And would that be a viable solution, if, you know, just from a very high level assessment?
Yeah, so I think one of the good things that we and opportunities that we had in oncology, we need to remember Costa Rica is has a very good health system around around the country. I mean, for example, cancer patients that are treated in 97% of the time within this national system, okay? But the thing is, I mean, this national system does not offer everything for the patients and even has a lot of things that are lacking in terms of medication, in terms of devices. So one of the opportunities that we had in oncology is that many of the things that we started to use within the clinical research were not given to patients. I mean, so patients obviously looked for other opportunities for them to have, I mean, a specific medication in oncology, for example. So this was the opportunity, I believe. In devices, I think there could be a very good opportunity. I mean, and in that case, I mean, if you have some device that it is not offered here for patients, or even the standard of care is not offered here to patients, this obviously becomes a great opportunity for you to expose a clinical research as a way to receive at least the standard of care. Okay, so that is something that definitely helped us in the beginning. Yeah.
So Beto, what do you think were your biggest hurdles in your construction here? You know, just started with this, you know, very specific project in three, and you've clearly grown this to, you know, you have a building built, you have multiple sites, you have multiple research coordinators and staff. And like, I think that you've grown this, you have a social media presence, multiple companies knowing you, you speak all over the world about some of these research that you've been able to do here. But in the process of you getting there, what were some of the hurdles that you had to maneuver? And if you had to do it again, what would you do differently?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, I can divide hurdles into two parts. The first part is the administrative hurdles that we had, because I mean this we started to have a clinical research unit in a time where there were no clinical research units that really were working. Okay, so as for example, as easy as a permission to have research. I mean, the government did not know how to give a permission because there was no form detail to fill. On giving a permission for a clinical research center. So
it was legal, but we don't know how to let you do it.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, there was no like paper said, well, check. No, there was no click, no checklist. Yeah. So this started, I mean, we started to work around things and obviously try to work as efficient as possible. The other important thing is obviously people, we came from a moment that there were 8 years that we didn't have research. So starting from the people, the population, I mean, the population, the people did not know what a clinical research was, clinical investigation. I mean, they still said, well, oh, no, I'm not going to go as a guinea pig to really receive something that you don't know what's going to do. Obviously, we need to educate the population, telling them what type of research is being done, phase three trials, what are they, what are they receiving, obviously. So that kind of things. The other even, and I think it was and has been still a hurdle, is that even the health community did not understand very well what clinical research was. I mean, if you started to think and you think that 8 years without any clinical research, I mean, there were a lot of residents that have not been around clinical research. Okay. So, I mean, if you're not around clinical research, you don't know what are the benefits of clinical research, how clinical research is done. I mean, even a protocol. I mean, what a protocol should contain, what an ethics committee needs to manage, to think about. So this was something that really was a big hurdle at the beginning, still is, but we have managed to incorporate many residents. We started to expose more of the research that we have been doing. For example, recently there was a big part of the medical congress here in Costa Rica that focused on research. Okay, and there, I mean, we gave information about studies that are opened, what have been. I mean, the benefits of clinical research, et cetera. And this is something that we need to continue doing for the health community here in Costa Rica to try and to push forward on this sense.
Do you think do you think there's something you would have done different?
Well, I think as you start to as time passes by and as you start to do things, you obviously learn from your mistakes and learn from things. Mm-hmm. So I think that the fact that we currently have what we have right now, it is because of that, of the mistakes that maybe we did at the beginning, of understanding what could be done in a better way. And we're doing it as of this moment. So we're trying to improve in many ways clinical research here, and I think there is a very big opportunity for other types of specialties, for other types of areas to be involved in clinical research. Still, we have a very, very few people who are incorporated in clinical research, and we need to really work around that to make Costa Rica a center for research within Latin America.
And Costa Rica has so many amazing things going for it, right? I mean, we're talking about a country that removed its military expenditure many years ago. The year was 1948. And has essentially vested in education. Fact of the matter is you can find an educated engineer in every corner of the country.
Yeah.
And that's why most of the companies that you and I work with, non-oncologic, granted, they have industrial you know, buildings down in Costa Rica. This is public knowledge. Inari announced that they're opening a factory. Mm-hmm. They're going to make catheters there. Lymphflow makes part of their devices there. Boston Scientific makes the V18 control wire, amongst other products. Abbott has pacemakers.
Yeah.
So there is this incredible, incredibly rich educated force that's there, and certainly at a, you know, at a reduced price, right? It's not going to be, the cost of living is going to be more than, for example, Nicaragua, mm-hmm. or potentially El Salvador or any of the other Central American countries, but it's not going to be comparable to New York City or Los Angeles. And you are going to get bilingual, friendly. I throw friendly in because I do agree that our country is very friendly, but bilingual, friendly, and educated, which I think are.
What do you think is a disconnect? Because I agree. I mean, I've visited Costa Rica many times, and I agree. It's a very kind of idealized society with a lot of educated people, great geography, great weather. What is the disconnect? Because wealth doesn't come from making the wires, right? Physically making them. Wealth comes from the idea of the wire and bringing that idea into reality and creating value in that process, right? So what is the disconnect in Latin America where we have these great, you know, petri dishes for success, where where that doesn't happen, where we don't talk about, okay, yeah, we can build the actual catheter, but how about we come up with the catheter? How about we come up with the wire? How will we come up? Because, you know, what Luis is doing is that, is creating value out of nothing, out of an idea, out of a process. So how can we create more of that instead of more hands-on making the catheter? Because
I think it's a matter of sophistication.
That's all.
I think that is becoming.
What does sophistication mean?
Well, sophistication in the sense of, you know, connecting the dots and understanding the potential of what we can do and how we can bring value to our idea.
So mindset.
Yes. Mindset. Yes, in many ways. Yeah. But I think that's becoming ever so less important. I'll give you I know this is very dumb, but this is a question that I am right now in my new company, mm-hmm. Searching for a partner for digital marketing and web designing. And I know this is completely mm-hmm. off, Beto, this is where we go on tangents, but here's the interesting thing. So this intermediate person that I hired to find me who the people that should be doing our digital landmark brings me these companies to talk to me, mm-hmm. vetted companies for me and said, okay, here are the three companies. One of the companies is in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. Like I went on this call and I'm like listening to these guys I'm like, that accent. And at some point I had to stop the call and I was like, my, it was testicle. Which means like, dude, are you a Costa Rican? And the guy's like, see mine. And I was like, do you live in the U.S.? He's like, no, I'm in King Heredia, like in a city in Costa Rica. Yeah. And like, I was like, why? Like, but that, I was very happy. By the way, they were hired on the spot. Boom. Yeah,
of course.
But I was very happy to see that we are getting to that level of a mindset where we understand that we can play in the big leagues, where we understand that our value at the end of the day is human value. Mm-hmm. It's entrepreneurship, is the spirit, is the intellectual power. And there's not a single little thing that we should, you know, what I told you in our last podcast, yo no envidio los goces de Europa. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be. There's no envious of what we can do. I think we could do it all the same and maybe even better, and we could do it cheaper. But it's a matter of sophistication and network.
Yeah.
You know, because your net worth is as much as your network. Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, having people like Beto that go to these meetings, that sit with the chair of the Mayo Clinic, and, you know, that know the CEO of a CleanLogix, the biggest CRO in the world, for example.
Yeah.
I think that's where you start realizing that in the future, and that was actually going to be a follow-up question, is do you have somebody that's created, for example, a medication in Costa Rica? And that there's some research you were, I think you alluded to, that there's potentially some opportunities of building, you know, medications. And I'll tell you an example. We build our own snake bite anti-venom thing in Costa Rica. Don't we? I mean, am I completely disconnected from my own country, or don't we do our own anti?
Yeah.
Okay, right. And so we actually identified from the species of snakes that we have, Instituto Cloramido Picao. Anyway, and they create it, and they make their own medication, and the hospitals have it.
Yeah.
Medications that you can't find in America.
Yeah.
They're not FDA approved because they're for snakes that live in our intertropical zone.
Yeah.
But anyway, all to say that we've been doing this for years. We've just never been sophisticated about it. But I would like to hear, Beto, do you believe that soon a 20-year-old engineer with a chemical background may soon come up with an idea of a new medication, and he comes from, I don't know, San Ramon, call it wherever, small little city, and that he can come somehow.
Or she.
Or she.
Just not get canceled.
Yes. They, them. And that they, them can come to you and say, I have the ability to research this. Now, granted, there's that phase one hiccup that needs to be fixed.
Yeah, that's the process.
But do you think we're going to get some sophisticated wealth building? Do you think somebody's going to become a multimillionaire in the next 10 or 15 years in Costa Rica from ideas from a Costa Rican in what you do?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, the opportunity, we have the opportunity. And one of the important things that I think we need to change is this, as you mentioned, the mindset of believing in an idea and trying to develop that idea till the end. I mean, we have very good quality universities, a lot of students that are working around these projects, but they stay there. They stay in projects. So I think one of the important things is that we need to have support. And this is something that unfortunately we lack in Costa Rica, national support, government support to promote these ideas. Because, I mean, many of these ideas are coming from universities, and many of these universities are public universities where they cannot build around development of a and going to the development of a big important product. I mean, and unfortunately, we do not have that support. And I think this is needed for us to maybe build something around. Because I mean, we do not have the private support that can obviously be an important opportunity again for a company, external, an international company that comes and starts to work around this type of research of these ideas that can become good ideas in the future. And definitely all the process, if we can manage to have the support, if we can manage to have this productivity as a way to expand and to really, really work around these type of studies, I definitely think that, I mean, we can have a very good product that was developed entirely here in Costa Rica.
I'm going to have one suggestion, and I think that's something that we don't do well as Latin Americans, is structured community support. And we always kind of think, oh, the government needs to do this. But remember, the government is some legislator with a basic
level of understanding of most things in the world. That's really, hoping on that, putting your hope in that, I think it's a mistake. You can do really simple things. And one of the things I think in places here like Austin, I've seen some things that are very interesting. Like sometimes I go to just startup meetups randomly. I have friends that are in startups and they say, oh, we're just going to have lunch and just talk. And then a group of people that don't know each other, all in different fields, but they're just building something, go and have a beer. And everybody introduces themselves. I'm doing this and this, and I need help in this and this. And eventually one person, I know a guy. And it's organic, it's small, and you don't depend on people that are not, don't have the incentives to help you. What the people that have the incentives to help you are people that are doing the same thing that you are. And then can find value in those things. So, this little things I've learned, I think that's something that we should foster, because I think that at least in Puerto Rico, I'm from Puerto Rico, that sort of kind of structured community building that's not necessarily as organic, because we're very close in a very organic way, but it's not about this mindset of growth and this mindset of creating value. It's around other things that are very good. But if we could kind of integrate that a little bit, I think we would find a lot of success.
I think that's the expansion in a way of also, sophistication, right?
Yeah.
To Beto's point, we have two really strong motors in the United States, which is government-funded research. Via, for example, the NIH, to give an example of one of the multiple institutions that actually fund research significantly. And then we have private research. Now, I know that Costa Rica may not get behind it may take a while to get some government funds moving in the right direction. But to your point, I think that there's an interesting project to get some of the elites in Costa Rica to fund some of these projects, of course, with the interest of wealth multiplication. And I think that's where, it'd be interesting if that's on your agenda at some point in the development of CIMCA. But it's like, what if I get a board of directors, of trustees of some sort, that are the guy that owns the Toyota, the family, because that's how it is back home. It's these big families that are multi-million dollar families, the guys that own, the McDonald's or the Burger Kings or this. But what if you grab one of each one of those and these people get together and they're like, listen, we're going to create private funds. They're privately held investment funds that we're going to do to propel Costa Rican scientists. But at the same time, if we hit a home run, we are going to make our families even 20 times more money than we have. And that's where I think there's a loss of sophistication in understanding that there is a very lucrative business also that could be associated to science and research. Mm-hmm. And that maybe what you need is people that have the experience, people that have been in the US for a long time that know how to deal with that. That could come and disseminate some of that culture and create a fund and understand how a fund is ran and have some of these people that have a lot of funds injecting funds into it. But anyway, Beto, I know we're getting here close to the end of this conversation, and I know you have a wedding to go to, which, by the way, weirdest wedding ever at 2:00 in the afternoon on a Friday. But hey, maybe this is going to be a great long party.
Well, this is a great excuse to just get to the open bar.
I know.
Here is a holiday. You need to remember, today is a holiday here.
What? Even remember your holidays.
What is it?
Today is a new holiday. And probably you've been living in the U.S. When this holiday was instituted, because this is the day of the abolition of the army.
Oh, that's a good holiday.
Wait, I like that holiday. And I even mentioned that. Was it what year? 1948?
Yeah.
That's a good
December
holiday.
December 1st, 1948 is now a national holiday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beto, I'm so sorry that I got you on a holiday. I didn't know that.
No problem.
I
mean, I've been here.
That's
no
a
problem.
New. That's a new holiday. I didn't know that. Anyway, Beto, before we let you go, where is Simca going? Where do you see the next 10 years of Simca? What would you like to see? If you could dream and you could have it all, how would this picture be painted for the next 10 years?
So, I mean, obviously we need to continue on this multinational clinical research. And this obviously is what keeps Simca going. But we want to be more proactive in the local and academic research. We want to try and to have more development on cancer in our country and understanding better what is a cancer for Costa Ricans and hopefully for Latin America. We are building networking around many centers in Latin America to work on projects within Latin America that come from Latin America. And if everything goes smoothly, we will have this first project at the beginning of next year. So hopefully the idea in the future will be to have much more research, much more academic research for us here in Costa Rica.
What about other specialties? Do you feel that Simca will get into gynecology, dermatology, cardiovascular disease, or is that just not of your interest? Do you think you'll lose little bit of your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, we have been debated around the around that topic. I think we have been focusing in oncology because it's what we know and understand of being a medical oncologist. And I think focusing sometimes is what gives you to the next step and gives you really a much wider. You're getting known because of some specific thing. And if we start to go and expand, maybe we'll lose this direction. That is what I think right now. I mean, I don't know, in 5 years I will think that, but currently, I mean, we're focusing only in oncology or areas around oncology.
Okay, well, I just want to remind you that I am moving back to Costa Rica when I turn 50. That is in like 7 years from now.
Yeah.
So I would like you to have an open mind for maybe some cardiovascular research. Cause if I could dream of a perfect future, would be one where I would be able to work with my best friend again. So, so keep an open mind. There's a lot of research in vascular care that could be brought to Costa Rica. And I think you would be the best person to direct it and to lead it. And it would be an honor to work for you.
Definitely. It's going to be,
I like the elevator pitch.
Did you see that?
Yeah. That was very smooth.
All right, Betico. Lucas, I think we should let him go back to his holiday and his wedding.
Have fun at the wedding.
Yeah.
What do you guys dance at weddings? Like what?
What?
Cumbia or something?
Listen.
Vallenato?
That is, I don't know if that's culturally insensitive in so many ways.
Bad Bunny.
No, we are salsa. Salsa and merengue is what are, but now I'm pretty sure reggaeton has just
of course
been an abomination of our culture. And
absolutely.
Well, that's my gift, my culture's gift to your
culture. Exactly. And we also on a daily basis get confused with Puerto Rico, which is so insulting. There's worse things. Anyway, Beto, thank you very much. You have a blessed day and we'll be in touch. Thank you for being part of the podcast.
Placer.
Un placer. Pura vida.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.